There is a picture of John Paul II sitting, all in white, on a chair in the corner of a jail cell, talking to the man who had tried to assassinate him in St. Peter's Square. The Pope had forgiven him then, but a couple of years later he'd come to the hitman's cell to forgive him face to face. Years later, he successfully urged the Italian president to pardon and deport the man. Now, as the product of a long line of Presbyterians, I find forgiveness on that scale both awe-inspiring and inexplicable. Ditto Erica, the widow of Charlie Kirk, at the huge memorial service in that Arizona sports stadium, declaring, "My husband Charlie, he wanted to save young men just like the one who took his life. On the cross our Saviour said, 'Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.' That young man, I forgive him." Lucy Allais, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Witwatersrand and Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, is in Sydney to deliver an Anderson Lecture at Sydney University this week. Her subject, forgiveness. Do we really need it? Professor Allais joins me now. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, forgiveness is an easy kind of idea until you start to look at it closely. And what happens when you begin to focus on what it is and what it isn't?
Those two examples you read out at the beginning are, I think, very striking for illustrating some ideas about what it might be, but also why we find it so puzzling. Both of those examples, I think, I mean, they raise a whole lot of really complicated issues. One of the issues which I... it's absolutely central to the cases, but I want to slightly set it aside, is the idea of religion. Because in my work, I've been trying to make sense of a secular account of forgiveness. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that a theological belief adds extra reasons. But so I'm not criticizing those reasons, but I'm just not engaging with them. I'm trying to think about what we might have reason to do if we didn't have those extra reasons. So I do think that, you know, you said at the beginning, it's both awe-inspiring and puzzling what could be going on
yes.
in those cases. And some people even think that it's a mistake to forgive unrepentant wrongdoers or wrongdoers who you don't know anything about, whether they were or not they're repentant. So my first response as a moral philosopher to those kinds of cases is to say, you know, philosophers have an enormous amount of debate about what exactly forgiveness is. And so I would be interested to know of those people exactly what they take themselves to be doing in forgiving, because they're different things you could take yourself to be doing. You could, as perhaps as illustrated by the Pope case, take yourself to be thinking that punishment isn't appropriate, that the wrongdoer shouldn't be punished. I don't know whether Charlie Kirk's widow thinks that at all, because you could also be taking yourself to be saying something like, "I relinquish anger towards that person," or just report, you know, I'm just not angry with them. I don't blame them. But that's where I think it gets extremely puzzling, what it could be to not blame someone for something that is so clearly something for which they are to blame. But, and that's where I think forgiveness gets puzzling.
Indeed, but forgiveness and punishment are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
I agree with that.
The victim can forgive, but the state can punish.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. But you might think that the victim who's forgiven wouldn't be seeking for the state to punish. Some people have that view of forgiveness. I agree with your initial impulse that they just sort of operate in different logical spaces.
But the Pope waited 20 years before suggesting
That's right.
his would-be assassin be forgiven and returned to Turkey.
So maybe he thought he needed a bit of punishment.
A bit of punishment as well.
Yeah.
It's not mutually exclusive at all. Is forgiveness more than anything a statement about the person who forgives, about the kind of person they are?
I think forgiveness is essentially a change. I see forgiveness as essentially being a change of heart or a change of feeling in the person who forgives. But I think that it's a change in feeling that's about the wrongdoer. It's about the person who forgives' way of seeing and emotionally being towards the wrongdoer. So I think it is a change in the person who forgives, But I think it essentially is about the wrongdoer. So I think it involves both.
The change being, I'm not going to be overwhelmed by anger. I'm not going to be overwhelmed by, I'm not going to exact revenge. I am going to change my attitude towards whatever it is that has happened.
So this is where I think it gets very complicated. So I do take it to be an emotional change, but I think there are also ways of giving up anger and resentment that are different to forgiving or less than forgiving or just something else. So for example, you could get over anger and resentment by putting the person out of your mind. You could also not be angry.
If you're capable of doing that.
If you're capable of doing that, sure. You could also not be angry by coming to see them as beneath contempt. So
yes.
Anger involves a certain kind of caring, I think. So I do think that there are ways of getting rid of anger that aren't forgiving. But I think that forgiving does involve an emotional change in which something close to anger, blame feeling, is released. And to understand that, I think it's really important to see, you know, we sometimes think, you know, we talk in like popularly as if emotion and reason are very strongly opposed to each other and are very different kinds of things. But philosophers and psychologists who work on emotions will pay quite a lot of attention to the content of emotions.
But they're not necessarily separate things,
exactly.
Are they?
Exactly. I think
in our own experience.
They're very closely related. So if I'm angry with someone, my anger has an object, which is that person, and there's a way my anger presents that person as being, and that presentation can be appropriate. Think about being fear. Fear presents something as dangerous, and that can be just a completely appropriate presentation of the thing. So our emotions relate to beliefs and are informed by beliefs and have content. And that content can be evaluated as appropriate or inappropriate. So when somebody's done something wrong, there's a kind of a blame feeling, a blame attitude,
yes,
that the wrongdoing warrants or makes appropriate. So what's puzzling about forgiveness is that it seems to overcome or release blame feeling that is still warranted.
I wonder whether it's also an assertion by the forgiver that they are, and I don't mean this in any, I don't mean this critically, I just mean that they are not like the person who has done this thing, that they are better, and also very importantly that they are stronger, and that they, as a victim, stand above the crime.
I think it can be that. And those can be ways of sort of reclaiming agency in the face of a wrongdoing which seems to take something enormous away from you. But I think that becomes a little bit less compelling when you think about forgiving in the context of an ordinary interpersonal relationship. You know, your partner's hurt your feelings and you're sort of feeling hurt and dwelling on that for a while and blaming them for a while, and then you forgive them and move on.
Yes, this is, Lucy, this is domestic scale.
But I think somebody
taking a pot shot at John Paul II in St. Peter's Square.
Absolutely. But I think forgiveness plays a role in both. And I think it plays a central role just in ordinary interpersonal relationships all the time. We do hurt our partners and families often, and they hurt us, and we do need to be able to move forward with them in ways that aren't keeping track of that forever. And so I think forgiveness is operative on both scales.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Lucy Allais, Professor of Philosophy at two universities simultaneously, University of Witwatersrand and Johns Hopkins University in the United States. Lucy, you make the point, which I find fascinating, that forgiveness isn't sort of what we're on about unless there really is something to forgive.
Yes. I think that's a super important point. The French philosopher Derrida, who was a fan of paradoxes, once said you can only forgive the unforgivable. Now, I don't think it's quite that paradoxical, but I think there's, you know, something that he's trying to get at there is that forgiveness is only at issue when there's unexcused, unjustified, unacceptable wrongdoing. So if I'm late to meet you, and then it turns out that, you know, bad weather caused the whole public transport system to collapse, you'll realize that I had an excuse and therefore there's no longer anything to forgive.
Yep, not your fault.
Not my fault. Or if I'm late to meet you and it turns out, you know, I run in late and I say, you know, I had to drive somebody to the hospital in an emergency. You'll say, oh, well, that was justified. So again, there's no longer anything to forgive. So you'll stop blaming me, but you'll stop blaming me because you come to see that there isn't anything to forgive.
But so, if, like me, you're just late because you're hopeless, then there really is something to forgive.
So, I think even in the case where somebody's just hopeless, an alternative response that's available to us is just accepting. So one can just choose to say, I'm no longer going to hold this person to account for this kind of action. But what's at issue in forgiveness is unexcused, unjustified, unacceptable wrongdoing. So we do think that the person should be held accountable. We don't think there's an excuse. We don't think it's justified. When it's justified or excused, there's actually nothing to forgive. And that's part of what makes forgiveness seem so puzzling, that it overcomes or releases blame and resentment and other angry feelings that are still warranted.
That are perfectly valid.
That are perfectly valid.
Mm. At the end of the apartheid era, there was a remarkable truth and justice commission in South Africa. And this is something that interests Australia deeply, because we are addressing, in deep history rather than contemporary politics, many of the same issues that were addressed there. How do you think that exercise worked? Do you think that exercise worked? Do you think your country is better for it?
It's an incredibly complicated question. I think it was a really morally and politically innovative solution to an incredibly difficult set of circumstances. I think we did more than most previous transitions managed. But so it wasn't, so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it wasn't officially about forgiveness at all. It was about finding out what had happened.
Telling the truth.
Telling the truth. Giving victims a chance to say what had happened to them, and giving amnesty to perpetrators who made a full and complete disclosure. So the full and complete disclosure was important, because in previous transitions, such as in Chile, the amnesty was a blanket amnesty behind closed doors. So by not having a blanket amnesty behind closed doors, there was a little bit more accountability, and there was people were seen for what they'd done. So what was sort of problematic about the TRC, or there are a few things that were problematic, but the thing that I think was most problematic is not the TRC itself, but what's happened since. So it was supposed to be the case, firstly, that perpetrators who didn't apply for amnesty would subsequently be prosecuted, but that hasn't happened. There was supposed to be more reparations for victims, but that was very limited. And then the TRC could only ever have been a very limited response. It wasn't ever going to be the body that could address the systematic impoverishment of the majority of the country. And because that hasn't subsequently been addressed, it makes the TRC process feel a bit like the real problems weren't addressed. But I think that's a little unfair on the TRC, because it couldn't have addressed economic disparities. And for what it was, I think it was a kind of amazing process.
Has it led to forgiveness?
So that's complicated. It wasn't actually supposed to be about forgiveness. And some people think that the role of the forgiveness in the TRC was problematic, because victims were put under pressure to forgive in problematic ways. So because there was such a strongly Christian influence at the head of the TRC, most obviously in Archbishop Desmond Tutu, there was a lot of talk about forgiveness, although it wasn't the TRC's official mandate. And some people think that was unfair on victims. There were some absolutely remarkable instances in the TRC of people being forgiving. expressing forgiveness and of really perpetrators and victims coming together.
Such
as? I don't think, people really forgiving murderers and torturers coming together.
The victims of Eugène de Kock.
Of people like Eugène de Kock. But the question that South Africans would raise about that is, that's a highly sort of individualized process. What the TRC didn't do is treat, it was a very important process for looking at victims of specific atrocities, but it wasn't looking at apartheid itself as a human rights violation of all black South Africans. So it wasn't the case that all black South Africans were given anything in that process. And that's part of what makes it controversial.
Except the story. Except that the stories were out. Did that make any difference, really?
I think it made a really big difference. I think it was really powerful. But it's a complicated issue because what was on display at the TRC was, by and large, it's a little bit more complicated. You know, all of these things are very complicated.
I acknowledge that.
But by and large, what the TRC was dealing with was acts that were illegal and atrocities, even by the standards of the apartheid regime. So the Eugène de Kock murders were authorized by the people at the top of the system, but actually illegal by the law of the day, as was torture. So the TRC was investigating atrocity, and there was a report which was also investigating apartheid as a whole system in which human rights violations could happen. But it wasn't straightforwardly just looking at apartheid as a wrong against every non-white South African.
I'm talking to Lucy Allais, philosophy professor at the Universities of Witwatersrand and John Hopkins University. I want to now take you somewhere where I don't think you're particularly happy to go, but I'm so curious. That forgiveness is such a strong part of a number of religions, not Presbyterianism, of course. I've made that clear right at the start. But doesn't that say something not just about religions, but about people? And about the power of forgiveness, that it is also said to be a direction of God. God wants us to forgive.
So, by the way, I'm not unhappy to go there. It's just not what most of my work has been about. I think forgiveness does play a central role in most religions. Even if you were to take just one religion, though, it would be complicated what that role is. So some people think that Christianity says you should always be forgiving, but some people think Christianity says you should forgive the repentant. Some people say that Judaism supports much more conditional forgiveness. One would need to be a detailed scholar of religion to have a deep view on that.
Indeed, and there's a view of religion, many religions, that they are vindictive, cruel, and seek to punish.
Also a view.
And forgiveness is very hard to achieve, perhaps very expensive to achieve. Yes.
So, and then other people think, so some philosophers will even think that forgiveness is a notion that we've inherited from religion and that you can't make sense of in a secular context. And I want to argue that you can make sense of it in a secular context, but I do think there is something really quite remarkable and transcendent about it. I think it involves, I think it's something really quite deep and powerful and also essential for our lives. I don't think it's limited to the religious context, in which it definitely has a large life.
Are there some things that are unforgivable?
So in my own view of forgiveness, I tend to be quite hesitant about being prescriptive to an individual who's been wronged as to whether they should or should not forgive. I tend to think that forgiveness is very strongly something that is the victim's discretion, that wrongdoers aren't entitled to forgiveness, and also that repentant wrongdoers aren't entitled to assert that they deserve forgiveness. But I also think that victims can forgive in the absence of repentance. And I think that that is an extremely personal and individual question. So in a way, I think there might be things which are unforgivable for a particular person in a particular relationship or for a particular person in a particular context. But I wouldn't want to say that nobody in that context could forgive that thing. If there's somebody who finds they can or that they want to, I wouldn't want to be prescriptive about that.
I'm thinking of something like the abuse of a child.
So it's a very charged and difficult case, but I still wouldn't want to prescribe that nobody in that position could ever be forgiving, and that if they were, they would be making a moral mistake. I think that it's possible. I think most of us wouldn't want to forgive and wouldn't find ourselves capable of forgiving. But I wouldn't want to say to somebody who did find themselves capable of forgiving, and maybe that even enabled growth and change and development and all sorts of other things, I wouldn't want to say to that person, you're doing something morally wrong by forgiving. Lots of philosophers would, actually, maybe most of them.
I can't imagine those responsible for genocide being forgiven.
Yeah, I also find that hard to imagine. But I think, you know, there's also a series of complicated questions about who has standing to forgive. And usually it's centrally the direct victim that has standing to forgive. So in cases where the victim is no longer around because the perpetrator has killed them, it's less obvious who has standing to forgive.
But survivors who forgive intolerable crimes could be regarded as extraordinarily noble.
They could be regarded as extraordinarily noble. So you know, there's debate about that. Some people think it's extraordinarily noble, and some people think it's morally wrong. Like, you shouldn't forgive those people. And I want to, in my view of forgiveness, I want to be quite careful about being prescriptive in either direction. I would be interested. Somebody who claims to be forgiving something terrible that's been done to them, I would be interested in knowing what exactly they take that to mean, because there are a variety of things you could take it to mean.
Yes. What about forgiving? Because, of course, monarchs used to have, and presidents now do have, a power to forgive. What about forgiving the mob that overran the Capitol in Washington on January the 6th, 2021? What do you think of that act of forgiveness by Donald Trump?
So, you pointed out earlier the distinction between legal punishment by the state and forgiveness, and I would want to say that though that's an act firmly in the territory of removing legal punishment. So that's a pardon. I wouldn't want to say that that's forgiveness. That's pardon, I think.
Lucy, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Absolute pleasure. It was lovely talking to you.
I've been talking to Lucy Allais, philosophy professor at the universities of Witwatersrand and John Hopkins, who is giving an Anderson lecture at Sydney University on the subject. Lucy, the subject is?
Forgiveness. Do we need it?
This is Late Night Live.